Good morning and welcome to the programme. Today, should Ireland follow Canada and advise that no alcohol is the only way to avoid health risks from drinking? We hear the expert medical view. Burning bushes and scrub on farmland has long been part and parcel of Irish farming, but now it's banned. Fianna Fáil TD Cathal Crowe tells us why he thinks it should continue. Stars from Janis Joplin to Jane Fonda and Marilyn Monroe made their home there. Dave Fanning on the myths, mysteries and legends around the Chelsea Hotel. The weight loss injection that appears to be in the celebrity toolbox, but should a treatment for obesity ever be used in an attempt to look good? Do you overfill it? Do you let the bowls overlap or do you put the pots and pans in there? Agnes Boucher-Hayes on the moral hazard of the dishwasher. She'll also have tips on getting the very best out of it too. 51551 is our text number. Email todaycb@rte.ie. On Twitter, we are at Today with Claire. First this morning, much of Ukraine is under an air raid alert this morning with reports of several explosions in the capital Kyiv along with other cities in the east, which has left at least one person dead and two wounded, according to the Kyiv mayor, Vitaly Klitschko. The strikes come 24 hours after commitments were made by the US and Germany to send advanced battle tanks to Ukraine. In a moment, I'll speak to defence editor with The Economist, Shashank Joshi, but first let's cross to Kyiv and speak to Christopher Miller, Ukraine correspondent with the Financial Times. Christopher, thank you for taking our call. Just describe to us what the situation is like where you are today.
Well, right now in Kyiv, it's actually snowing. The sun is peeking out and it's quiet at the moment. But about 2 hours ago, we heard a series of loud explosions. And then Mayor Klitschko, as you said, reported that one person had been killed and two people had been injured after part of a missile that was shot down by Ukrainian air defense struck some type of building just south of where I am in central Kyiv. There was a second building on the east side of the river outside of the city center that was also struck. So we're waiting to get word as to what exactly was hit and what the damage is going to be like. But this is part of just the latest wave of missile attacks and attacks with Iranian-made drones by Russia in the past several months.
Okay. And I know residents where you are used to getting these warnings to take shelter, but it seemed like a very urgent one overnight from the authorities saying stay in shelters until the air raid alarm goes off. And you yourself were tweeting about hearing explosions from your apartment.
That's right. Yeah, my building shook and the explosions were actually pretty loud. I saw several people scatter across the street running for shelter in the metro system, which doubles as a bomb shelter here. And overnight, people didn't get a lot of sleep. There were air raid sirens and alerts throughout the night. The one that we got this morning was the sixth alert in the past 24 hours. And then shortly after that alert is when the first missiles struck and the explosions reverberated across the city.
And do you know if those missiles did strike or was it an interception that you heard?
There was one strike, as far as we know, and then there was an interception south of the capital as well. And at that location, I believe, is where Mayor Klitschko said that the one person had been killed and two others injured.
Give us a sense then of what's been happening across Ukraine, because it's not just the capital city that has been targeted.
That's right. Missiles have rained down on several cities today and overnight in Odessa in the south, in Zaporizhia, a city, an industrial city in the south center. And then several missiles also and rockets from multiple launch rocket systems have struck targets in eastern Ukraine, where there's where the focus of Russia's ground war is currently happening. So many of your listeners will probably have heard and read about cities by the name of Bakhmut or Kramatorsk or Kramina. Those types of places that are still seeing infantry fighting and in really intense fighting between Russian soldiers on the ground and Ukrainian troops. Okay. So there's very much a ground war happening in the east and the south while missiles are flying and hitting targets elsewhere across the country.
And we know, Christopher, over the last couple of months that the targets have been the energy infrastructure. Is that still happening?
Yeah, I think that is part of what Russia is doing. You know, certainly the Ukrainians and President Zelensky himself have said that Russia is launching these attacks to sow terror and chaos, but they are also targeting infrastructure and trying to knock out power systems, water supply lines, heating elements. Right now, as I speak to you, I currently have power, but the city of Kyiv is on a power saving schedule. So any moment here, my power might go out, as will many other people throughout the capital, for about a block of 4 hours. And this is a way of conserving energy while these attacks occur.
Okay, Christopher, stay with us if you can, because I want to bring in Shashank, who's with us on the other line, defense editor with The Economist. And Shashank, I see that from the Kremlin, we have this line on the wires this morning: Western tank deliveries are direct involvement in Ukraine conflict. What we're seeing today, is that a retaliation by Russian President Putin in light of what happened yesterday with that announcement from Germany and the United States?
I very much doubt it. These Russian attacks on electrical infrastructure and other targets have been sporadic, but in some ways regular since October, when they began in earnest. They take some time to plan because they are hitting very specific parts, in some cases hitting very specific parts of the electricity grid, including difficult to replace or repair parts like substations and transformers. And they take a while to plan. So this is not something the Kremlin dreamed up on 24 hours notice. Mm-hmm. They're also taking time to recover and build up their weapon stockpiles because they are running low on the precision-guided munitions being used for some of these sorts of strikes. In other cases, they're using Iranian drones, which are also not unlimited in number. So in my mind, there had been a while since these strikes anyway. I think it had been a little bit of time. I don't know exactly how long. But we were overdue a strike of this manner. Kiev, you know, Moscow wasn't stopping these. So I would take the Kremlin to claim for this to be a response with a huge pinch of salt.
Christopher, what do you say to that?
I agree. I think that's right. You know, like my colleague said, these attacks have been ongoing since October. And while we were overdue, and this may have been planned, you know, it may be that this attack had been planned for around this time. They just saw an opportunity to do so after the announcement of these tank deliveries. But I don't think that it was specifically because of these announcements of tanks being delivered to Ukraine that this missile attack was launched.
And Shashank, do you expect there to be down the line some sort of retaliation?
I think the problem the Kremlin faces is it's pulled most of the levers it can pull. It has expanded attacks to include attacks on civilian critical infrastructure. It is mobilizing hundreds of thousands of men and continues to do so, although it's musing the prospect of another wave of mobilization of a similarly large number. So when we talk about retaliation, there are not many steps Russia can take without actually escalating the war in ways that could be unfavorable to Russia. We've already seen the United States provide HIMARS rocket launchers that absolutely wreaked havoc on the Russian forces from the summer onwards. It's not clear to me why the provision of tanks, main battle tanks in particular, would prove to be a threshold that over which the Kremlin would suddenly start attacks on European soil or of other sorts. That said, I do think we should be open to the prospect of other kinds of Russian retaliation over the medium term. And that could include things like attacks on European critical infrastructure in more covert ways. We've seen the explosion of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipeline last autumn, disruption of satellite infrastructure, disruption of undersea or long-distance communication cables. Those are all the sorts of things we could expect to see, but all of those come at some cost to Russia, and they would also involve a degree of risk on the part of the Kremlin.
Okay, because we know that Ukraine is now saying we want F-16 fighter jets, and people might ask, well, if the tanks are going there, does that open the door to the next step, and where does that take us?
That's certainly what Defense Minister Reznikov here in Ukraine and Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba and President Zelensky are hoping, is that jets will now be very much a part of the conversation. I apologize. My bell is ringing here.
That's okay. You go if you need to, Christopher, because I'm aware that you may be in a slightly delicate situation, being as you are in Kyiv with all of that going on today. Shashank, can I ask you that question? This request from Ukraine for F-16 fighter jets. Now, the Dutch. Have we lost Shashank Joshi?
Okay. No, I'm here.
You're here.
I'm here and listening.
Great.
I'm happy to address it.
It's just that the Dutch seem to be amenable to that request, and you just wonder, where does the provision of tanks lead us?
Well, over time, over the year of this war, we have seen a steady advance in the nature of the weapons the West is willing to provide, beginning with portable anti-tank weapons and air defense missiles to artillery pieces, to rocket launchers, all the way up to main battle tanks and some very sophisticated bits of kit. In fact, the most advanced tanks that exist in the West's arsenal. So I would not be surprised if we see other sorts of weaponry arrive. And I think the two big ones are, first of all, Western aircraft, the F-16 being one of them. The other one, sometimes mentioned in connection with Ukraine, is the Saab Gripen, which is a Swedish-made fighter jet that is quite small, quite versatile. It can take off from limited runways, including civilian roads, and therefore it's quite suitable for Ukraine's needs. The other item that is on Ukraine's wish list and would be up the rung of options would be the so-called ATACMS munition, which is a rocket that goes inside the HIMARS launcher, fired from the HIMARS, but it can go a lot further than the existing munitions that have been provided so far. The Biden administration has said it won't provide it because it would be capable of striking deep inside Russia, but I think that's the sort of thing we could expect to see come back onto the agenda over the coming months.
It's just interesting to see how things have changed. I mean, in the early months of the war, requests to impose a no-fly zone around the bordering countries, those countries bordering Ukraine, that was a conversation that almost couldn't be had. And now we're talking about sending fighter jets.
Yeah, of course, the difference is that the no-fly zone conversation was about Western countries establishing a no-fly zone over Ukraine as they did over Libya in 2011, for instance, or over Iraq in the 1990s. This conversation is about providing jets to Ukraine's air force, which is indirect. It maintains the cardinal rule of the Biden administration, which is no direct involvement. In fact, that's a NATO consensus. No one wants to be directly involved. There is some money allocated in Congress for training Ukrainian pilots. The worry is, I think, that they are, losing a lot of their old jets. If their air defense ammunition runs out, it would open the skies above Ukraine to Russian fighter jets again. And so they would absolutely need their own jets. And the current ones they have are outranged and outgunned by the Russians. Their missiles can fire a lot further. So I think this is a conversation that does need to be had. But it will take even longer to train Ukrainians on F-16, say, and to train them how to maintain them than it will on a tank. So we're talking here many, many months of work. This isn't something that's going to happen by the late spring or the early summer.
Can I ask you again about these tanks? Because I see the German defense minister saying that some of them might be available and in Ukraine by the end of March. So there's about 2 months to go there. The American ones are going to take even longer, with some saying yesterday up to a year before they're provided. What real difference are those tanks going to make to Ukraine?
Well, they'll give it the option of what tanks do best, which is protected, protected mobile firepower. So effectively, you've got three things combined in a single package. It has a big gun, in the way that it can bring firepower down in the way of artillery. It's mobile, that is, it can sort of move through enemy defenses if it finds a gap and exploit those gaps. And it's protected, that is, it can withstand fire from artillery in the way that, say, a soft-skinned vehicle or a lightly armored vehicle can't. Nothing else combines those three things. And so if they can cobble together enough for an offensive armored brigade, they can try and bust through Russian lines at a weak point. And it's very difficult to do that in the current circumstances, where Russia has been fortifying its lines, deepening its defenses without tanks. But on the timelines, it's vital to note the American tanks are not something that is going to influence the spring fighting. It's just not. These are viewed as long-term investments in Ukraine. It's the Leopards that will make the difference in the shorter term. But it isn't just about how quickly can you get the tanks to Ukraine. It's how quickly can you train their crews, how quickly can you train their combined arms teams, that is the artillery, drone, engineering units that go with them. How quickly can you train their engineering and recovery units? For example, these tanks are much heavier than Soviet-era tanks, so they need completely different bridging units. All of that stuff is going to take much longer than just handing over tanks, telling them how to turn the keys and getting them off and running.
You mentioned spring fighting there. What are you expecting to happen?
Well, the honest answer is nobody knows, but we certainly expect that both sides are seeking to find some reserves and options for an offensive. Ukraine to take back territory, but where, we don't know. Will it be in the east, in the region that Chris Miller mentioned, in Donbass, or will it be in the south, in Kherson province, in Zaporizhia province or somewhere around there, and the Russians, in order to try and do what Putin wants, which is not just sit on the defensive, but to go back on the offensive, and that would be more likely to come, I think, in the Donbass, particularly in Donetsk province, around some of the towns that Chris mentioned, things like Bakhmut and places like there. So I think the challenge for Ukraine is if they go too early, before they have all these tanks at their disposal and trained personnel, they risk suffering very bad casualties and opening themselves up to a Russian counterattack at their most vulnerable. If they go too late, then Russia may have attacked first, pinning the Ukrainians down. So I think this is a real concern for both sides as to get the timing of an offensive right. But it will come. And for Ukraine, they need to take their territory back. And for Russia, they need to basically show this isn't a failing war. And that's why we saw the commander of the Ukrainian forces, Surovikin, demoted just a couple of weeks ago, with the chief of general staff put in charge of the entire operation, because Putin wants to go back on the offensive.
Shashank, thank you very much for joining us. That's Shashank Joshi, who is defence editor with The Economist. And my thanks to Christopher Miller, who joined us earlier too from the Financial Times. And Christopher is based in Kyiv. Coming up next on the programme, Sinn Féin's election expenses.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.